Diablo and San Onofre both have built on earthquakes. Haven't you seen enough of an earthquake to see what it does? You also are in a tsunami area. What update do you need except to close it down?
Help us.
No, well, I'm helping you.
We have to do it.
Look, I live in Australia. I'm only one person. I mean, I'd march in there and take over the control room, shut the thing down if I could, and that's what you should be doing. Have courage. Have courage. Have courage. Have courage.
This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, radio that does not ask permission to have courage. Today on the show, a continuation of readings from Deep Green Resistance, music by Remember Me Feral, Big Duty Roo, Resident Antihero, Smoke Fairies, Filthy Politicians, and more. This is Rage, building a community of resistance one podcast at a time. Welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwiski, Wiskaigan. I am your host, Seymour Life. Off the top of the show was a little piece of Helen Caldicott talking to people in California about nuclear plants and fault lines and asking them to have courage. I'd like to bring to everyone's attention some events going on in June. In solidarity with Pine Ridge, DGR Great Plains and other DGR groups joins the March for Justice 2012, always in memory of Wallace Black Elk and Ron Hardhart. Date June 9th, 2012 at 12 p.m. Location Billy Mills Hall, Pine Ridge, South Dakota. A day of action against white clay, Nebraska. For more details, check out deepgreenresistance.org. Also, DGR presents a Culture Resistance East Coast Roadshow, traveling from Miami up the East Coast. Come out and join people building a culture of resistance from the grassroots up. Both of these great events also need your support. If you cannot attend, support through donation online. Please check out Deep Green Resistance for more information on donating and these events. We continue today with readings from the book Deep Green Resistance, done by DGR cadres and volunteers. Today's show is about choices that will ultimately show our true morality.
The appropriation of Native American religious practices has become so widespread that in 1993, elders issued a statement, the Declaration of War Against Exploiters of Lakota Spirituality. The declaration was unanimously passed by 500 representatives from 40 Lakota tribes and bands. The statement could not be clearer. White people helping themselves to Native American religious practices is destructive enough to be called genocide by the Lakotas. The elders have spoken loud and clear, and indeed even reaffirmed their statement. We should have learned this in kindergarten. Don't take what's not yours. Other people's cultures are not a shopping mall from which we, the privileged, get to pick and choose. Americans are living on stolen land. The land belongs to people who are still, right now, trying to survive an ongoing genocide. Those people are not relics of some far distant, mythic, natural state before history. They live here, and they are very much under assault. Native Americans have the highest alcoholism rate, highest suicide rate, poorest housing, and lowest life expectancy in the lands now known as North America. From every direction, they're being pulled apart. Let's learn from the mistakes of the Vondervogel. Their interest in peasants had nothing to do with the actual conditions of peasants, nor with the solidarity and loyalty that the rural poor could have used. It had everything to do with their own privileged desires. Judging from my many years of experience with the current alternative culture, nothing has changed. The people who adopt the sacred symbols or religious forms of Native Americans, the pipe ceremony, Inipi, do it to fulfill their own perceived needs, even over the Native Americans' clear protests. These Euro-Americans may sometimes go a step further and try to claim their actions are somehow anti-racist, a stunning reversal of reality. It doesn't matter how much people feel drawn to their own version of Native American spirituality, or how much a sweat lodge, in all probability led by a plastic shaman, means to them. No perceived need outweighs the wishes of the culture's owners. They have said no. respect starts in hearing no. In fact, it cannot exist without it. Just because something moves you deeply, or even speaks to a painful absence in your life, does not give you permission. As with the Wandervogel, the current alternative culture's approach is never a call for solidarity and political work with Native Americans. Instead, it is always about what white people want and feel they have a right to take. They want to have a sweat lodge experience. They don't want to do the hard, often boring work of reparation and justice. If, in doing that work, the elders invite you to participate in their religion, that's their call. Many people have longings for a spiritual practice and a spiritual community. There aren't any obvious, honorable answers for Euro-Americans. The majority of radicals are repulsed by the authoritarian, militaristic misogyny of the Abrahamic religions. The leftist edges of these religions are where the radicals often congregate, and that's one option. You don't have to check your brain at the door, and you usually get a functioning community. But for many of us, the framework is still too alienating and feels, frankly, unreformable. These religions have had centuries to prove what kind of culture they can create, and the results don't inspire confidence.
Talk about natives, talk about who's this place is, talk about a culture and how we erased it, a livable system and how we replaced it. Colonize and make a fake nation, can't get a seat, they just got reservations. Take away the children, put them in a school and take away the customs. White man's rule, watch everything they love get put to death. The forest no more, it's a mess. We call it all backwards, aren't they savage? Then we go rape, pillage and ravage. Why do you think some drink so much and who gave them alcohol? Oh yeah, us, we fuck them right up, take their life away. Then we deny the role that we play, the role of a lifetime. God, let your light shine down so bright we can get them in our crosshair sight. Once again, 2010, when they try and fight the politics, fuck the Olympics. Here to tell you why the fuck this all matters. Same people today, it's still going at her. Muskets turned to machine gun chatter. Hear the noise of that paradigm shatter. The world's watched for so long. If we set up shop on top and moved on, juggernaut won't stop, we'll keep moving on. If we can't even see it on our own front lawn. Now in school they teach us about the natives and how we defeated. Get right to the point with no lies. So now as kids we're desensitized to the fact that we came and destroyed a people. They twist and blur our vision of what's evil, but they leave out the violent details. They kill the children and rape the females. These so-called Christian crusaders shoot first, ask questions later. Damn manifest destiny invaders, not Jedis, more like Darth Vaders. And that isn't so good now, is it? Bet you never had a perspective so different. Do we think that's the right thing to do? Like that's the way it is, believing the truth so screwed. Still the past can't be changed, but to keep being ignorant will be insane. If you look closely at the ones to blame, the same ones today killing us the same. We're here to tell you why the fuck this all matters. Same people today are still going at her. Muskets turn to machine gun chatter. Hear the noise of that paradigm shatter. The world has watched for so long as we set up shop on top and moved on. Juggernaut won't stop, gonna keep moving on. If we can't even see it on our own front lawn.
What we never hear is that Hitler modeled his plan for Lebensraum after the conquest and destruction of the First Nations in North America. In that respect, the only difference between the Nazis and this culture is that so far no one has stopped this culture. Stop this culture. Stop this culture. Stop this culture.
Why deep green resistance? Because I love this land where I live. I love the rivers that flow through it. I love the insects that hum in the air over my head, and I want to see them live and flourish, and I will do anything I can to stop their death.
We're up against a system that is not only unjust, but insane. A culture of resistance must collectively face the layers of horror embedded in history. The daily acts of sexual sadism that comprise slavery, conquest, and rape. The knowledge that these acts are not the mistakes of confused, tragic children, Forgive them or not, they know what they do. A culture of resistance believes in resistance because no amount of love or compassion or earnest education, no shining example of communal sustainability or individual self-respect has ever stopped the powerful. Continent by continent, sustainable and egalitarian cultures have been wiped clean off the map, mere smudges of history that stood in the way of wealth, and the individuals who led them, brave, self-respecting, stalwart, took their place at the hanging end of a noose or beneath the heavy bodies of the hateful. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will, wrote Frederick Douglass with the dense eloquence of those who know too well. A culture of resistance is the mitosis of those demands, where the twin strands of pain and courage are triggered into life. As every living cell carries the message, life wants to live, so too a culture of resistance is a determined miracle. However long the odds, life will live and people will fight. The odds are longer now than they've ever been. A shadow stretched with vanishing species and rising carbon. But there are warriors who might yet throw their bodies between the last of our future and its destroyers, if only they have a viable strategy and visible support. So the question is, will the rest of us help them? Will we cast our lot with them, speak in their defense, shelter them in danger, sing songs of their stories, raise our children to take their place, prepare the way for their victory, claim them as our bravest and brightest? Another 200 species went extinct today. Make your choice.
Time for you, for me. IDGR, this world that we live in, that supports us and gives us life, the only world we have, is being destroyed so that a few extremely privileged people can feel extremely powerful and live lives of extravagance. The people who benefit the most from the murder and enslavement of Earth and its inhabitants will not voluntarily end their destructive behavior. The people who benefit the most from this destruction have no more care for my life or your life than the lives of the forests that they've turned into deserts, or the mountains that they've turned into moonscapes, or the 500,000 human children who die of starvation each year to pay for their own colonization, or the 200 species that went extinct today. We resist because we have to. We resist because we want our children to have a future. We resist because we hear the screams of a dying planet. And we resist because we know that the bodies of our loved ones are full of industrial toxins. We resist because we don't have time to wait.
This book is about fighting back. The dominant culture, civilization, is killing the planet, and it is long past time for those of us who care about life on Earth to begin taking the actions necessary to stop this culture from destroying every living being. By now we all know the statistics and trends. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There is 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the oceans. 97% of native forests are destroyed. 98% of native grasslands are destroyed. Amphibian populations are collapsing. Migratory songbird populations are collapsing. Mollusk populations are collapsing. Fish populations are collapsing, and so on. 200 species are driven extinct each and every day. If we don't know those statistics and trends, we should. This culture destroys land bases. That's what it does. When you think of Iraq, is the first thing that comes to mind cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touched the ground? One of the first written myths of this culture is about Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq to build a great city. The Arabian Peninsula used to be oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. We've all heard of the cedars of Lebanon. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. We'll say it again. This culture destroys land bases. And it won't stop doing so because we ask nicely. We don't live in a democracy. And before you gasp at this blasphemy, ask yourself, do governments better serve corporations or living beings? Does the judicial system hold CEOs accountable for their destructive, often murderous acts? Here are a couple of riddles that aren't very funny. What do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. What do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? The answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, which caused the mass murder at Bhopal. Do the rich face the same judicial system as you or I? Does life on Earth have as much standing in a court as does a corporation? We all know the answers to these questions. And we know in our bones, if not in our heads, that this culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. We, the authors of Deep Green Resistance, have asked thousands upon thousands of people from all walks of life, from activists to students to people we meet on buses and planes, whether they believe this culture will undergo that voluntary transformation. Almost no one ever says yes. If you care about life on this planet, and if you believe this culture won't voluntarily cease to destroy it, how does that belief affect your methods of resistance? Most people don't know, because most people don't talk about it. This book talks about it. This book is about that shift in strategy and tactics. This book is about fighting back. We must put our bodies and our lives between the industrial system and life on this planet. We must start to fight back. Those who come after, who inherit whatever's left of the world once this culture has been stopped, whether through peak oil, economic collapse, ecological collapse, or the efforts of brave women and men resisting an alliance with the natural world, are going to judge us by the health of the land base,
by what we leave behind. They're not going to care how you or I lived our lives. They're not going to care how hard we tried. They're not going to care whether we were nice people. They're not going to care whether we were nonviolent or violent. They're not going to care whether we grieved the murder of the planet. They're not going to care whether we were enlightened or not. They're not going to care what sort of excuses we had to not act. Example, I'm too stressed to think about it. Or, it's too big and scary. Or, I'm too busy. Or, but those in power will kill us if we effectively act against them. Or, if we fight back, we run the risk of becoming like they are. Or, but I recycled. Or any of a thousand other excuses we've all heard too many times. They're not going to care how simply we lived. They're not going to care how pure we were in thought or action. They're not going to care if we became the change we wished to see. They're not going to care whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green, Libertarian, or not at all. They're not going to care if we wrote really big books about it. They're not going to care whether we had compassion for the CEOs and politicians running this deathly economy. They're going to care whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. We can fantasize all we want about some great turning, but if the people, including the non-human people, can't breathe, it doesn't matter.
Humans, I'm afraid of humans. Torej, dolgo časa sem spremljala uničevanje, ekološko in drugačno uničevanje planeta. In to, kar me je bolelo, je bilo, da nisem na noben način znala najti pravšnjega odgovora, kako se temu upreti in kako to ustaviti. Potem je v roke prišla knjiga Deep Green Resistance in končno so se te zadeve začele nekako sestavljati v mozaik, ki je imel smisel, ki je pokazal najprej, kje so razlogi, potem pa tudi, kakšne so možne poti odgovorov na to destrukcijo. So why Deep Green Resistance? I was actually hurt for a long time just witnessing the destruction of Earth and not knowing how and what to do to stop it. And while reading Deep Green Resistance, the book, I finally figured out the actual reasons and the need, the strategical need of fighting back.
Somebody, after all, had to make a start. What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They just do not dare express themselves as we did. Sophie Scholl, The White Rose Society. DGR has a very different goal from anti-colonial struggles. The Green Book, for instance, puts the goal of those struggles clearly. Quote, to make the six counties ungovernable except by colonial military rule. This has no parallel in the decisive ecological warfare strategy we are describing. None. DEW has only that one goal at the heart of its strategy, to disrupt and dismantle industrial civilization, and to thereby remove the ability of the powerful to exploit the powerless and to destroy the planet. Our actionists are not trying to change consciousness. They're not trying to get press. They're not after a new government or a seat at a political table. They are trying to stop the burning of fossil fuels and industrial-scale destruction of the life support systems of their planet. That is the goal of DGR, and DEW is their strategy.
Let's Night shadows on dreams lament. Once buried our warriors with dirges, gave them trills of everlasting names, tears and songs. Could hear our war cry from the top of the mountain, knew we were coming and feared it. But you stopped our tongues, hid our words into the dust, almost forgotten. Fear has made our voices still no longer. We will sing a vibration breaking ground, you will fear us. We will sing a we have been given the power of the word, and we will use it. 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 People not jail this tongue. Fear will not break this spirit of earth. Comrades from the soul. Sing out and more. This is anthemic. Hold on, we are coming. Hold on, we are coming. Hold on, hold on, we are coming. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, yeah, yeah. Hold on, hold on, hold on, yeah, yeah. Hold on, hold on.
Radical groups have their own particular pitfalls. The first is in dealing with hierarchy, both conceptually and practically. The rejection of authority is another hallmark of adolescence, and this knee-jerk reactivity filters into many political groups. All hierarchy is a tool of the man, the patriarchy, the Nazis. This approach leads to an insistence on consensus at any cost, and often a constant meta-discussion of group power dynamics. It also unleashes critiques of everyone who achieves public acclaim or leadership status. These critiques are usually nothing more than jealousy camouflaged by political righteousness. Bourgeois is a perennial favorite, as well as whatever flavor of sellout matches the group's criteria. It's often accompanied by a hyper-analysis of the victim's language use or personal lifestyle choices. There is a reason that the phrase politically correct was invented on the left. There's a name for this trashing. As noticed, Florence Kennedy called it horizontal hostility. And if it feels like junior high school by another name, that's because it is. It can reach a feeding frenzy of ugly gossip and characterization. In more militant groups, it may take the form of paranoid accusations. In the worst instances of the groups that encourage macho posturing, it ends up men shooting each other. Ultimately, it's caused by siding horizontally rather than vertically. If the only thing we can change is ourselves, or if the best tactic for social change are lifestyle choices, then, indeed, examining and critiquing the minutiae of people's personal lives will be cast as righteous activity. And if you're not going to fight the people in power, the only people to fight are each other, writes Denise Thompson. Horizontal hostility can involve bullying into submission someone who is no more privileged in the hierarchy of male supremacist social relations than the bully herself. It can involve attempts to destroy the good reputation of someone who has no more access to the upper levels of power than the one who is spreading the scandal. It can involve holding someone responsible for one's own oppression, even though she too is oppressed. It can involve envious demands that another woman stop using her own abilities, because the success of someone no better place than you yourself makes you feel inadequate and worthless. Or it can involve attempts to silence criticism by attacking the one perceived to be doing the criticizing. In general terms, it involves misperceptions of the source of domination, locating it with women, who are not behaving oppressively. This behavior leaves friendships, activist circles, and movements in shreds. The people subject to attack are often traumatized until they permanently withdraw. The bystanders may find the culture so unpleasant and even abusive that they leave as well. And many of the worst aggressors burn out on their own adrenaline to drop out of the movement and into mainstream lives. In military conflicts, more soldiers may be killed by friendly fire than the enemy, an apt parallel to how radical groups often self-destruct. To be viable, a serious movement needs a supportive culture. It takes time to witness the same behaviors coalescing into the destructive patterns that repeat across radical movements, to name them and learn to stop them. Successful cultures of resistance are able to develop healthy norms of behavior and corresponding processes to handle conflict. But a youth culture, by definition, doesn't have that cash of experience, and it never will.
Why DGR? Because everyone and everything we love can't afford for us to do anything less.
This is a question on which the entire world may depend. Are you willing to accept the only strategy left to us? Are you willing to set aside your last fierce dream of that brave uprising of millions strong? I know what I am asking. The human heart needs hope, as it needs air. But the existence of those brave millions is the empty hope of the desperate, and they are not coming to our rescue. But a few hundred exist, answering to the name of Mend. They are the direct descendants of Kansarawiwa and eight others who chose to fight with their lives as their only weapon. Those lives ended in a tight noose of vicious power, tied by the military on behalf of the global wealthy. But their struggle didn't end. On that grim day, power didn't win. Because now Mend is willing to say to the oil industry, leave our land or you will die in it. Are we willing to do the same? To say, leave our mountains, our wetlands, our last ancient trees, leave our kin of feathers and fur, who every second are slipping away from the world and into memory. Are we willing to fight for this planet? The Black Panthers wanted to have a national gathering, but there was no safe place for them to hold it. The Quakers of the Philadelphia Meeting House, despite serious and profound differences on the issue of nonviolence, offered their largest meeting house, and more, they circled the building to keep the Black Panthers safe from the police in an act of extraordinary solidarity, putting their lives between power and the resistance. Will you offer your meeting house? There are polar bears and black-footed ferrets, bison and coho salmon who need a safe place. Where will you put your life? Will you offer your meeting house? The resistance needs a place too, a place to gather its forces, find its courage, and launch the final battle. The carbon is swelling, the heat is rising, the rivers are fading, and somewhere a black tern is giving up in exhaustion. The same noose that took Kansarawiwa is tightening, and there is only time for one last breath. Will you close your eyes and let the earth fall, with the sickening snap of species and forests and rivers? Or will you fight? Whatever you love, it is under assault. Love is a verb, so take that final breath and fight.
People often mistake the spirit of resistance. They see it as anger and hatred and imagine its taste to be bitter. But resistance is founded in love. We find some things so beautiful and love them so deeply, so urgently, that when we identify systemic oppression that endangers them, we must resist. People often misjudge this motivation and feel it's a personal attack on them as individuals. But resistance is not something to be feared or to hold disdain for. Resistance is a passionate movement for the preservation of beauty. Resistance is a passionate movement for the preservation of beauty.
The system cracks as we break through it. It's love that fuels my desire to resist.
acting defiance, violently grasp my bliss. It's love that pulls its energy up inside me, guides me, fills me, pushes me to fight thee. I love resistance, I love diversity of tactics, from lawyers and suits to a bank window as you crack it. I love resistance, I love standing up to oppression, I love my obsession, I love watching the enemy crumble beneath the schemes, landing our dreams. I love our dreams, I love our dreams.
I'm involved with EGR primarily because it's the only organization right now and to date in the environmental movement that has come up with a strategy with goals, objectives, and a vast array of tactics that matches the size and scope of our problem. I believe that DGR is an organization that is, in the first and last instance, aiming to stay faithful to the Earth and everyone that calls Earth their home. The strategy is fluid, it's flexible, and I think that it can respond to the needs of the planet, and again, the people that call it home. That's what makes it a viable endeavor, I think, is the fact that the unwillingness to be bogged down into certain kinds of dogmatism, certain kinds of ideological purity. What I like to say a lot of times is when everything's at stake, everything then is on the table. Of course, part of the above ground of DGR doesn't include the kind of tactics that, you know, are really harped on the book. I think that it puts everything on the table that an above ground can put on, and the organization of DGR currently, I think, is doing everything it can do to foment a resistance that has a real possibility of seeing life on this planet come back, and not just come back, but also thrive.
Our story begins on a day like today. Somewhere, the question happens, will you join me? The question is a risk, but weighed against the aching despair of another 200 species and 29 degrees of heat, the risk is taken. The test of intellectual agreement and the trust of character will already have been established. All that's left is for someone to ask it, will you join me? The question is asked again, and then again, 6 times, 10 times. The first meeting is held, tactics discussed, tasks dispersed. Someone's job is to keep asking the one question, to find others, to multiply outward until there are enough. Enough doesn't just mean numbers. Enough means trained bodies, disciplined habits, dependable behavior, an unshakable moral core. Our lack of purpose is not our strength. It is our profound downfall. And this revolution is not for the hell of it. Enough means courage and an acceptance of the sacrifices that may well lie ahead. And enough also means thoroughly understanding the strategy we are proposing. We are not the Weather Underground or the Red Army faction. Jeremy Varone, in his History of Both, writes, 1960s radicals were driven by an apocalyptic impulse resting on a chain of assumptions, that the existing order was thoroughly corrupt and had to be destroyed, that its destruction would give birth to something radically new and better, and that the transcendent nature of this leap rendered the future a largely blank or unrepresentable utopia. DGR is not a secular millennialism. The revolution is not nigh, general chaos is not going to bring it on, and essentially symbolic acts on people or on property are of no strategic use. Cross those attacks, all of them, off the list now. This is true whether the targets are large or even monumental, or small and accessible. DGR is not a desperate call to act on whatever targets are at hand. If this is a struggle against an opponent with a scorched earth policy, then our strategy has to aim a wee bit higher than the windows of your local corporate outpost. So put away your bricks and spray paint. Those are not weapons for the serious. From this point forward, we aim to be effective. And because our detractors will be determined to misunderstand, DGR is not a call for an armed insurgency. The idea is absurd. A few radical environmentalists could not possibly take on the U.S. military. A DGR strategy does not include pitched battles, ever, or Theodore Rosak's fist fight with the nearest cop. Our goal is not to bring down the U.S. government or any government. The realm of broad and transformative political change is best left to the above-ground groups working on scales from the local to the international. Such campaigns demand mass movements, and, in all probability, nonviolent tactics, and there are examples from around the world for study. DGR is a fight against a singular enemy, industrial civilization. This makes us different from every other struggle in history. It has some similarities with the original Luddites. Newsflash, they were right. It also has overlap with indigenous peoples trying to forestall displacement, extinction, due to dams and mining. But those indigenous are mostly having to fight while rooted in place, protecting their land and their survival. They cannot win in pitched battles against the might of armies in the service of capitalist profits. The movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, or MEND, offers a more successful model for DGR, using the flexibility and surprise that are the strengths of a guerrilla strategy. But because the enemy is not a military, we are left with wrenching ethical decisions. If there are people between us and our targets, they are not soldiers. We can say that civilization is a war against the living world, but that does not answer the moral dilemma of putting living beings at risk. I have no answer. Only an emergency the size of land, sea, and sky. I never asked to be in this position. Insisting that there is still somewhere a win-win solution that leads the civilized to that voluntary transformation is a stance of willful denial against all the facts, and I cannot turn away from my moral agency to ease my moral agony. I am forced to weigh the fact that actions have consequences, sometimes dramatic and unpredictable ones, against Oxfam's words on climate change. The prospects are very bleak for hundreds of millions of people, most of them amongst the world's poorest. This is not a dilemma that I created. It is the dilemma I am trying with all I have to stop. I can't put my longings for emotional ease and innocence above the emergency, biotic and human, to which history has abandoned us. All I can do is beg the people who might read this book, please do everything you can to spare all sentient life.
Like a schoolyard bully stepping on a little girl. One dog is barking, trying to spread the news. One dog is barking, trying to spread the news. Gotta save our planet. can't you hear her moan and cry? Mother Earth and weeping, can't you hear her moan and cry? Sounds like a one dog barking, trying to save our mother life. Can't you hear her moan and cry? Can't you hear her moan and cry? Well, now Mother Earth and weeping, can't you hear her moan and cry? Mother Earth and weeping, can't you hear her moan and cry? Sound like a one dog barking, trying to see my mother line.
The U.S. Army's Field Manual, entitled Operations, introduces 9 principles of war. The authors emphasize that these are not a checklist and do not apply the same way in every situation. Instead, they are characteristic of successful operations and, when used in the study of historical conflicts, are powerful tools for analysis. The 9 core concepts are: objective, direct every military operation toward a clearly defined, decisive, and attainable objective. A clear goal is a prerequisite to selecting a strategy. It is also something that many resistance groups lack. The 2nd and 3rd requirements, that the objective be both decisive and attainable, are worth underlining. A decisive objective is one that will have a clear impact on the larger strategy and struggle. There is no point in going after one of questionable or little value. And, obviously, the objective itself must be attainable, because otherwise efforts towards that operation objective are a waste of time, energy, and a risk. Offensive. Seize, retain, and exploit the initiative. To seize the initiative is to determine the course of battle, the place, and the nature of conflict. To give up or lose the initiative is to allow the enemy to determine those things. Too often, resistance groups, especially those based on lobbying or demands, give up the initiative to those in power. Seizing the initiative positions the fight on our terms, forcing them to react to us. Operations that seize the initiative are typically offensive in nature. Mass. Concentrate the effects of combat power at the decisive place and time. Where the field manual says combat power, we can say force more generally. When Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest summed up his military theory as "get there first with the most," this is what he was talking about. We must engage those in power where we are strong and they are weak. We must strike when we have overwhelming force and maneuver instead of engaging when we are outmatched. We have limited numbers and limited force, so we have to use that when and where it will be most effective. Economy of force. Allocate minimum essential combat power to secondary efforts. In order to achieve superiority of force in decisive operations, it's usually necessary to divert people and resources from less urgent or decisive operations. Economy of force requires that all personnel are performing important tasks, regardless of whether they are engaged in decisive operations or not. Maneuver. Place the enemy in a disadvantageous position through the flexible application of combat power. This hinges on mobility and flexibility, which are essential for asymmetric conflict. The fewer a group's numbers, the more mobile and agile it must be. This may mean concentrating forces, it may mean dispersing them. It may mean moving them, or it may mean hiding them. This is necessary to keep the enemy off balance and make that group's actions unpredictable. Unity of command. For every objective, ensure unity of effort under one responsible commander. This is where some streams of anarchist culture come up against millennia of strategic advice. We've already discussed this under decision-making and elsewhere, but it's worth repeating. No strategy can be implemented by consensus under dangerous or emergency circumstances. Participatory decision-making is not compatible with high-risk or urgent operations. That's why the anarchist columnists in the Spanish Civil War had officers even though they despised rulers. A group may arrive at a strategy by any decision-making method it desires, but when it comes to implementation, a hierarchy is required to undertake more serious action. Security. Never permit the enemy to acquire an unexpected advantage. When fighting in a panopticon, this principle becomes even more important. Security is a cornerstone of strategy as well as of organization. Surprise. Strike the enemy at a time or place or in a manner for which they are unprepared. This is key to asymmetric conflict.
and again, not especially compatible with an open or participatory decision-making structures. Resistance movements are almost always outnumbered, which means they have to use surprise and swiftness to strike and accomplish their objective before those in power can marshal an overpowering response. Simplicity. Prepare clear, uncomplicated plans and clear, concise orders to ensure thorough understanding. The plan must be clear and direct so that everyone understands it. The simpler a plan is, the more reliably it can be implemented by multiple cooperating groups.
Hunger, mistreatment of the older and younger. I've seen people choose to sell their mind for a fabricated lifestyle they don't find. Defeated by systems of control. Protect your mind and protect your soul, or they'll take all of it, then install a chip. Broadcast, upgrade, reboot, polish it. Mechanized like a metronome. Jam frequencies or they'll get your dome. We moved up out the concrete electric haze and make war on machines till the end of days. Not really machines, but they're not human beings. They can stop with the schemes, cause there's something in between. Regimen and routine that's keeping my conscience clean, and the satellites they beam won't ever reach in my dreams.
We don't want a worldwide globalized government. Machines are in control and they fucking love it if they wanna mechanize and control the world. Put computer chips into every boy and girl. So we anti-systems of control. Here to take it all back, everything that they stole. Anti-systems of control. Protect your mind and protect your soul.
So consider it filed. I don't want no computer chip in my child. No retinal scan, computerized, compiled. And no machine culture, cause my earth is wild. Hair, blood, mucus, teeth, and claws. And no systems of courts, penalties, and laws with flaws. Unfixable, unprincipled. International oligarchs think they're invincible. Underground silos, weapons that's chemical. Standards of beauty where girls look identical. Prefixes, subclauses, fine-printed contracts. Packed with acts that protract the facts. Spiderweb, tentacles, mechanized thoughts. Systems and secrets where truth that is bought. Your mind is the place where the war is fought. So protect what is left and defend what you got.
We don't want a worldwide globalized government. Machines are in control and they fucking love it. If they wanna mechanize and control the world, put computer chips into every boy and girl. So we anti-systems of control. Here to take it all back, everything that they stole. Anti-systems of control. Protect your mind and protect your soul.
We'll be right back.
Why deep green resistance? Because it offers a real strategy, one that doesn't depend on changing the minds of those who wield oppressive power. DGR recognizes that domination is not a misunderstanding, and systemic violence is not an accident. In light of the catastrophic destruction of the natural world, and the unimaginable escalation of that destruction that looms, hinging our strategy on the whims of the perpetrator represents a dangerous naivete. Resistance means changing the material circumstances of oppression, whether or not we've gained the approval of the oppressor.
Whatever work you are called to do, the world can no longer wait. Power in all its versions, the arrogant, the sadistic, the stupid, is poised to kill every last living being. If we falter, it will win. Gather your heart and all its courage. Fletch love into an arrow that will not bend and take aim. Will you join me? The clock starts now, the moment you put down this book and think as hard as you've ever thought. Who can I ask to join me? Our clock doesn't tick off seconds. It advances by species and carbon. How many and how much since you started this book? Will you join me? In the time it takes to write that question, another amphibian has dropped into the abyss of extinction. Another flower will never stretch and bloom. Another native elder slips with her language from the world. In the time it takes to say yes, there is still time to make the possible real. There is still time for amphibians as a class, still time for justice to win against power and its rancid pleasures of domination. Will you join me? Pass that question not from mouth to ear, but from heart to heart. It will have to be whispered, but it can still blaze. Let it circle the globe until it comes all the way back. Will you join me? Yes, it is possible. But yes, like love, needs to be a verb. Our best and only hope. Let it guide your aim. Then let it loose.
Descending all morning,
This next piece is not from Deep Green Resistance, but from a book called What We Leave Behind by Derek Jensen and Eric McBay. This piece is taken from pages 191 to 195. Legacy. Quote, "Whatever I have said about my deeds and words in this trial, I let stand, and I wish to reaffirm it. Even if I should see the fire lit, the faggots blazing, and the hangman ready to bring the burning, and even if I were in the pyre, I would say nothing different." End quote. Joan of Arc. What will be your legacy? What will you leave behind? Will it be regions deforested by your actions and inactions? Will it be the wreckage of forest communities you destroyed or allowed to be destroyed? Will it be lots of money? Will it be forests you did not work to save? Will it be remnants of forests you worked to save, as I worked to save this one, but did not succeed in saving, as I did not succeed with this one? Or will it be forests you saved? How many families of slender salamanders will continue to live because of who you were and what you did? How many coho salmon, how many green sturgeons, how many warblers, whippoorwills, chickadees, phoebes, bobwhites? How much deeper will the soil be because of you? How many tons of greenhouse gases will not have been emitted because you lived? Because you acted? I'm not asking how few you caused to be emitted. I'm not letting you or me off the hook that easily. I'm asking how many you caused not to be emitted because of your actions. There is all the difference in the world. Will your legacy be a world who is healthier, stronger, more resilient, more diverse than had you never lived? If not, the world would have been better off without you. If not, the world would have been better off had you never been born. This is neither an accusation nor a threat, but a simple, even tautological statement of fact. But these questions of whether you make the world stronger, more diverse, healthier, and these questions hold for any relationship, point way past self-centeredness. These questions point towards a morality that works for the common good, the real common good. In other words, they point us towards a real morality. Would the world, the physical world, be a better place had you never been born? Is the world, the real physical world, a better place because you were born? These are the most important questions. What are your answers? Why do you answer as you do? Once again, is the world a better place because you were born? What would Earth say in answer to those questions about you and I? She feels how we walk in this world. How would she comment on our morality? I hope you enjoyed today's show. Taking us out is Big Duty Roo with People Said No. I'll add this to my endings from now on, and it's not a metaphor. I hear rivers screaming, and I smell the blood of trees on the wind. The resistance needs you. Will you join us?
All the people said no.
Will you join us?
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 Hey, asa nam pridružiš?
Will you join us?
Will you join us?
Will you join us?
Will you join us?